Everybody from President Obama on down says they want a more open and transparent government. Still, when releasing government-held data sets to the public, it's important to strike a balance between providing open data and protecting citizens' privacy. Well, how do you do that? For some answers, we turn to Emily Shaw, the Deputy Policy Director at the Sunlight Foundation. Emily, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
All right. So you have published an anecdote in which, probably trying to be transparent, a former governor, Jeb Bush, published emails that he received as governor, and that really did more harm than good, apparently.
Well, we observed that in that particular case, releasing all of those emails was intended to show the governor's transparency and willingness to be open. But in fact, because he didn't carefully redact them, they ended up potentially harming the people whose private information was shared in those emails. It just illustrates how it's important to understand both possible redaction techniques, as well as the benefit that you're seeking to gain by making the release, in determining the right way to do it.
I mean, at the federal level, the default seems to be don't publish at all because of the possibility of that personally identifiable information getting out. So are they erring, again, at the federal level, too much toward caution and avoiding some transparency they could have?
Well, you know, you have to have sympathy for the people whose job it is to make those calls, because what they're trying to do is walk a very careful line between opening the government appropriately and following the laws to make information available, at the same time protecting information they're legally required to protect. We argue that by improving the level of quality of the data that you have, it's much easier to redact the information in an appropriate way, and in ways that humans really can't do with the kind of volume of information we're talking about. So, you know, we urge those decision makers to invest in the tools that you need to do it appropriately.
You said increase the quality of the data that you have. How does that apply to, say, a set of emails, for example?
Well, if information is available in digital form originally, it's easy to transfer it into another digital form that can be automatically redacted by a software program. However, in a lot of cases, government agencies are used to working with PDFs or with printouts even, and so they will turn it into a form that can only be read by humans. If it's a printout, then it will never again have the quality that can be used to automatically redact it, and it needs to be done by a person. If it's a PDF, often similarly, it can't necessarily be used by the programs that could do it more consistently. So higher quality means machine processable, and there are a lot of programs that can be used to automatically redact in a way that's kind of a more consistent quality than humans can bring to it.
So in other words, a tool, for example, could look for the @ and take out email addresses?
Right, exactly. Or social security numbers, which is a really serious identity concern and shows up not infrequently in public materials where it shouldn't exist, but, you know, sometimes people accidentally include it.
Because, you know, there is the data.gov and there is the imperative, and I think they've just refreshed that whole idea of federal agencies releasing more data sets to the public. In your experience, how much personal information tends to be in federal data sets, such as those that are released for people to build apps from or whatever they want to do with them?
For the most part, agencies are pretty protective of their data. And so the ones that get put out, tend to have been through significant vetting processes. And what I've often seen, I mean, you're talking about many, many, many data sets, so haven't been through, even a significant percentage of them. There's a lot of data that has zero personal information in it. In the work that we that you alluded to, we looked at some that were specifically about individuals. So, thinking about emails is one category, thinking about databases of lobbyist registrations is another. And in many of those cases, it's important to have personally identifiable information because that's the point of the database. So in those cases, that's where the challenge is greatest, because when you have a need to understand what individuals are doing or, you know, what their role is in a particular process, you just have to be careful that certain categories of information are not included, as opposed to individual level information altogether. And in a lot of databases, individual level information, especially as it pertains to real people, is not as significant. And so you see different kinds of aggregates, which are useful. You see time and geolocation data, which is also really useful, but doesn't necessarily identify individuals in that mix.
And turning to a related topic, of course, the administration has had some pretty tough problems, or maybe they're not problems, maybe it's intentional, we don't know, but Freedom of Information Act requests responses have been pretty low, and some agencies, a few large agencies, have been particularly lax in clearing their backlogs and responding in a timely manner. Could one reason for this be that they don't have these redaction tools they feel they need, and so they, if it takes so long to do it by hand, could that be holding up the FOIA process, which has, you know, gotten pretty stagnant?
We really believe that improving the incoming quality of information and, you know, the material that they're processing, keeping in digital form, is a great idea. And, you know, this might be a tech lag that hopefully, you know, we'll see rectified soon, because, you know, a lot of the recent redaction techniques have required, the kind of more familiar redaction techniques have had this requirement or the common kind of feature of being either in PDF or in hard copy. And I think we're seeing, you know, more adoption of newer techniques that are speedier and can be automated. I mean, obviously with human oversight, but it's not as onerous as being the first line of redaction. So we hope that does transform the availability of public information. We frequently argue for it.
We're speaking with Emily Shaw. She is the Deputy Policy Director at the Sunlight Foundation. And I wonder, maybe people in government putting emails into printout form and putting documents into PDF form because they're worried about the cybersecurity side of them when they're electronic, which is, you know, a different problem altogether.
That is certainly a consideration, but there's no reason to believe that the people who are really interested in gathering that information wouldn't themselves go to, human surveillance of those documents too. Just because something is in PDF doesn't necessarily mean that, people who are looking to steal information won't look there as well. It just, you know, makes it so that computers can't necessarily find it as quickly. But, you know, they know where the sources of information are going to be, and they're also looking at non-public information, obviously, as in the recent, hacking examples. Those were not public documents. We're talking about a category of documents that's been passed through multiple levels of review. I want to point out that, you know, a lot of hacking instances where we think about the release of private information were never about public databases, and those were from sources of information that were not intended to be made public and so were appropriately containing private information.
Sure. Now, you've also mentioned in relation to that the Justice Department's Foreign Agents Registration Act database. That's the one you mentioned earlier. What makes that one so particularly valuable?
Well, my organization likes to be sure that we have access to information about influence on governmental decision making. In the U.S., we have means of lobbyists, information about lobbyists through lobbyist disclosure laws. This is lobbyist disclosure laws for people from outside of the U.S. So in order to understand how foreign governments lobby our government, which is a regular activity that occurs just like it occurs from, you know, domestic actors, this is the database that captures those expenditures and those activities. So it's very important, if you're interested in understanding influences on our governmental decision making, to know, you know, who's trying to make their voices heard. And so this is the database that reveals those actors.
All right. So who should be responsible for all of this in agencies to make sure that data is releasable in a safe way? Should it be deemed something that the agency wants to release?
Well, agencies have been dealing with this, you know, for well over a decade, you know, and practically two decades at this point. And so they've evolved structures where they understand that data management and review and release is part of their process. And so they have folks involved with the governance of the data that they hold and that they're obliged to make public. It's a matter of change always being kind of a tricky thing to manage in large organizations like U.S. governmental agencies. The fact is we see new changes in this in the commercial sector annually or, you know, semi-annually. It is a relatively rapid pace of change. And so we're trying to help the U.S. government catch up to what is a more common practice, perhaps outside of government, but nonetheless is the kind of level of data quality expected by, data users in this country.
And so, go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to ask you earlier, you mentioned some tools that government should invest in so that when they keep things in their original electronic formats, they can be more easily redacted. And so describe some more of those for us, because we mentioned one about the types of tools that can spot, say, email addresses or social security numbers and black them out or remove them.
Right. Yeah,
what are some others?
Well, the primary tool is to make sure that the data is collected and is maintained in digital form. And there are several kinds of common formats for data that allow you to apply, all kinds of new code that comes out to search for specific snippets of data, or allows government programmers to develop code that will look for, a kind of data string that might be unique to that particular data set. So, common government or common formats that we like to see data kept in include XML or CSV or tabs limited format or JSON are, kind of our canonical forms of data that allow for a lot of kinds of manipulation. So it's something that makes it flexible, makes the data flexible enough to accommodate changes and improving over time.
All right. Emily Shaw is the Deputy Policy Director at the Sunlight Foundation. Some good advice. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.